Dear students, welcome to Chapter 6. And I know Chapter 5 was a lot of stuff for you to learn, but you gotta learn it. In this chapter, we are now going to turn our attention to how one comes about a valuation for a stock. We talked about all different characteristics and different types of stocks and where they're traded. But how do we come up with a number for what a stock is worth? Well, the market does that fairly efficiently because there are people all around the world bidding on the prices for what they will buy it and what they will sell it for. But how do we take a look at that stock and say, well, we think it's worth this much? The market might say it's worth more, might say it's worth less. And those techniques are called valuation techniques. And I love this quote on slide number one from a mutual fund manager with over 35 years experience. He's been in the business a long time. And he said it very succinctly. Value matters. You ignore value at your peril. Right. Just because everybody else is paying a certain price for a stock doesn't mean that you should pay that price. You need to decide what it is worth to you. Slide number two. The valuation process. The process by which the underlying value of a stock is established on the basis of its forecasted risk and return. That's the processes we're going to learn. We're going to learn some. There are dozens and dozens. We're just going to learn a few. And we're going to find out that it's not that easy. At any given time, the price of a share of common stock depends upon investors' expectations about the future behavior of the security, of the stock, of the company. A fundamental assertion of finance holds that the value of a stock is based on the present value of its future cash flows, which in the case of most stocks, are what is it going to earn? And then some stocks, many stocks, will pay us dividends. So, this makes perfect sense, doesn't it? The worth of a company is primarily based on the earnings that the company will produce in the future. It's not about right now. It's about what's going to happen in the future. But if we knew what was going to happen in the future, it would not be called the future, would it? Right? Exactly. Does anybody really know what's going to happen in the future? Well, yes and no. You often have an idea of what's going to happen, but you don't know when, or you're not sure at all. It's like forecasting the weather, only worse. Slide number three. This is from a random walk down Wall Street, and this gentleman is a very good writer. He was one of the people involved in the, which we'll discuss later on, efficient market theory back in the late 60s, early 70s, and he got involved with Vanguard, and he helped John Bogle create the Index 500, the index fund, the Vanguard Index 500. They weren't the only ones doing it, folks, but they were certainly the most popular and most successful. Stock valuation. He says that the most fundamental influence on stock prices is the level and duration of the future growth of earnings and, for some companies, dividends. However, future earnings growth is not easily estimated, even by market professionals. And so this is one of the books that it's in the bibliography that you want to read eventually. It's on the website. Check it out in Chapter 5, Books to Read. So if someone were to ask you, what is the most important factor in determining the future value of a company? In a few words, you could say future earnings. What's the company going to earn in the future? Or you could say future dividends, right, if this company is paying dividends. But do any of us know what is going to happen in the future? No. Sometimes you do, but you just don't know when. For example, we knew in 1998, 99, 2000 it was going to end. It wasn't going to. We just didn't know when. The tech bubble, and the same thing is true in housing. We knew some people deluded themselves into thinking it was never going to end. And I think of the Greek tragedy. You know there's going to be bodies on the floor by the end of the play. You just don't know how long the play is going to end. So is valuing stock going to be easy? A resounding no. It is not easy. So why are we trying to do it? Well, we got to come up with some way of putting a value on the company, right? Indeed. Slide number 4, security analysis. And this is the process of gathering and organizing information and then using it to determine the value of a share of common stock. And there's a wonderful book that eventually many, wait till you read One Up on Wall Street, Random Walk Down Wall Street, The Intelligent Investor, but there's a book by the teacher of Warren Buffett, Benjamin Graham. He also wrote The Intelligent Investor, called Security Analysis. And they basically created, he's often called the father of fundamental analysis, the father of security analysis. The idea is to find the intrinsic value. What is this thing worth? The underlying or inherent value of a stock as determined through the processes that we use that are called security analysis. The question is, what security analysis methods or measures does one use to determine the intrinsic value of a company? Because there are many. Should we look at the future dividends, the future earnings, the potential capital appreciation? Some people do that. They're more speculative. Is the stock price going to go up? The price-to-earnings ratio, we'll discuss that in more detail. The financial ratios that we'll take a look at in much detail in our next chapter. Past price performance, that's coming way down the line. That's technical analysis that people use. Well, what's it done in the past? Does it mean it's going to do it in the future? Well, I don't think so. At least history doesn't tell us it will. How much risk? How do you measure risk? Right? We know that there's no perfect measure for risk. This is the problem. The value is in the eye of the beholder. One person looks at the company and sees a tremendous value. Others say, yeah, I wouldn't touch that thing with a 39.5-foot pole. Slide number 5, fundamental analysis. This is the examination of a firm's accounting statements and other financial and economic information to assess the economic value of a company. And here are some of the examples. The competitive position of the company. Are you Costco or Walmart? Or are you Sears and Kmart? Are you Coca-Cola? Or are you PepsiCo? Or are you Monster? It used to be called Hanson's. The growth prospects for a company and its market. The profit margins. The company earnings. What assets are available. The capital structure. It's a fancy word for how much debt do you have. How much do you own of the company and how much do your creditors own of the company? Simply put, in fundamental analysis, the value of the stock is influenced by the performance of the company that issued the stock. Now, this seems like perfect common sense, doesn't it? And in many ways, I think it is. I mean, it doesn't mean it's easy. It's just common sense. What we're going to find later on is that there are people who don't care about these fundamentals, and they more look at different indicators. They're called technical indicators, and these are called technical analysts. So they're on the way on the other side of the world. Two worlds collide. And, of course, some people are somewhere in between. So we'll take a look at technical analysis much later on. We're going to concentrate on fundamental analysis, and I tell you right up front my bias, right? So you know. I think the technical analysts are all wet. I think the fundamental analysts are where you should be. But that doesn't mean it's easy, okay? It just means you should concentrate on the company that is behind the stock. That's my personal belief. Let's continue. One of the types of analysis is called financial ratio analysis. One method. We look at certain financial ratios. Financial ratios give us a quick and easy method for comparing one company to other companies within their industry or the stock market as a whole. The problem with financial ratios is that there is no single financial ratio that can adequately sum up or summarize the overall general state of affairs, the situation, the predicament, etc., 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 that the company finds itself in. And there are many of these. We'll take a look at the price ratios, in this chapter, and then in our next chapter, we'll look at many others. And I'll repeat myself, so my apologies, but Benjamin Graham was a big fan of the father of value investing, taking a look at financial ratios. We can't just look at one ratio and say, that's the reason I'm going to buy a stock, or, that's the reason I'm going to sell a stock. We have to take a look at all of them in the context of one another, and we have to look at their competitors, too. We have to look at the companies that they compete with. So, again, I apologize, I'll repeat myself, but let's continue. Slide number 7. The most popular, and certainly for many people the most important, stock market statistic is the price-to-earnings ratio. Now, this is a bit of review. We introduced it in Chapter 5, and we're going to take a look at it again in this chapter, and then we're going to take a look at it again, because it's such an important statistic. On the face of it, you know, at the first look, it's actually very simple. You just take the price and divide it by the earnings. But what it connotes and what it signifies is more subtle depending on the company. As we said back in Chapter 5, historically P.E. ratios were in the 5 to 12 range for mature companies, 14 to 20 was what we would expect for growing companies, greater than 20 was unusual, but at certain periods of time, the P.E. ratios have gone way past this benchmark of 20 for a growing company. And we saw in the 1980s and 1990s that they went into the hundreds, and it happens. And now P.E. ratios are all over the map. And so we have four companies here that really have nothing other than to do with one another, except that they all start with the letter F. That's the big reason. So you know all these companies. Maybe you don't know First Solar. They're a solar panel, a solar company. But FedEx, Ford, Facebook, right? So let's take a look at the P.E. of FedEx, 26.1. Well, what does that mean? That means that investors are fairly optimistic about the prospects for FedEx. It's a well-run company, folks, as far as I can determine. And people admire them. And certainly, are they going to go out of business anytime soon? No. You know, their major competitor, who is it? UPS. You got to look at UPS. And you have to look at the Postal Service and see what they're up to. And then there's another one, DHL, which is based in Germany, right? But they're all global companies, folks. You got to take a look at them globally. But what we can say with a PE of 26.1 is that investors are fairly optimistic about the future prospects of FedEx. Now, the question is, are they right? We'll know in 3 to 5 years. That's the problem, right? You can't be sure. That's why we say predicting the future value of a company is very, very tricky. We'll see whether investors will be rewarded by buying a stock with a PE of 26, far above the average of about 16, 17, 15, or whether they will be disappointed, because if FedEx doesn't deliver, no pun intended, if FedEx, the company, doesn't do well over the next 3 to 5 years, what's going to happen? Right, exactly. The price will be bid down, and yeah. Now let's take a look at another company, Ford. 8.6.
Ugh.
What is going on here? Well, what are investors saying? It doesn't mean they're right. Remember, investors are saying that they don't think the prospects for Ford are that great. And yet, the company, in my humble opinion, has done pretty darn well since the financial turmoil of 2008 and 2009. They're building cars that in the United States and Canada are and Mexico too are very, very popular. So they're doing well in North America. Now, how are they doing in Europe? Not so great, and they really don't have an Asian presence to speak of, which they're working on. So investors are not too excited about Ford's prospects, are they? Are they correct? We'll know in 3 to 5 years. But by then, exactly, it's too late. Right. You have to decide, after you've done all your research, and we'll take a look at some of the techniques in these two chapters coming up, whether or not people are too pessimistic about Ford. Because if they are, this is a very good opportunity. And as we said back in Chapter 5, investors will call FedEx a growth company because it has a high PE, and they'll call Ford a value company because it has a low PE, but that doesn't necessarily mean that FedEx is not a good value, and it doesn't mean that Ford is a good value necessarily. It may be... It may not be. And now Fleecebook. I'm sorry, Farcebook. Facebook! Let's see what they're... But, what? 112? Folks, just a couple months ago, it was over 200. Right, Facebook is the archetypal growth company now. They're on the cover of Vogue and Vanity Unfair and GQ. And investors are very excited about the prospects of Facebook. They believe that Facebook's future is very, very bright. So they have bid the price up to the point where it's almost laughable. But if they deliver, and how does Facebook make its money? Well, they make some money from companies selling them data about you. But mostly what they want you to do is click on those little ads on the screen, because that's how Google makes their money, right? So Facebook wants to steal what Google has, and they want, see, Google, you search for something and then you click on it. Facebook wants to figure out what you want before you even know you want it and then show you the ad. And if they're successful, they're going to make a ton of money, folks. And if they're not successful, exactly, they'll become my Facebook, and or they'll become, I don't know. You're asking the wrong person. I don't use the thing. I only created a Facebook account just so people wouldn't steal Wonder Professor and create confusion for my students. And on my Facebook page, it says, I don't use Facebook, contact me via wonderprofessor.com, and I have 40 requests for being a friend, and most of these people have no idea who they are. So, hey, we'll see, you know, we'll see whether Facebook really deserves a PE of 112. Remember that Google had a high PE when it was first public, and it turned out that it was justified. Investors were very well rewarded. We'll see. That's why some people like to say you pays your money and you takes your chances. This is capitalism. And then let's take a look at First Solar. First Solar is actually a very interesting company, folks. And for those of you who are business-oriented and like to take a look at business case studies, their PE, if you take a look at their PE over the last several years, it has been sky high and then down below the street, and they have just been all over as people get very excited about solar and then very depressed about solar and very excited about solar and very depressed about solar. It's been a schizophrenic stock, to say the least. And what are investors now? 11.6? They're not too excited. But, hey, you know, we eventually have to do something about our addiction to oil, but let's not get into that because that has political overtones, depending on who you talk to. But I can tell you that my wife and I have had solar panels now for over 10 years, and within a few years now, I have to go back and recalculate, but pretty soon, about 4 or 5 years, they will have paid for themselves, and then we get our energy, our electricity at least, for free for the next however long we live, because these things will outlive you, assuming that someone doesn't throw a rock on top of your roof. Okay, so much for the commercial. Slide number 8. Historically, a company's P.E. ratio was supposed to match its growth rate. If a company was growing at 20% per year, then a P.E. of 20 was justified. During the internet bubble, many companies had P.E. ratios in the hundreds. Right? That's why a lot of people are saying it's internet bubble 2.0 because of Twitter and Facebook and all these other social media stocks. I never forget this, and as long as I live, I looked down at the Quotron, which was, you don't even see them anymore, but it was at the brokerage firm I was working at, and eBay's PE was 10,000. This was in late 99 or so, late 90, and I thought, this ain't going to last. I didn't know when. I thought it would be another few years before the thing crashed and burned. It was a lot sooner. It was in March of 2000 was the peak. 10,000 PE, right? See, the PE ratio tells you how long it will take in years, assuming there's no changes in earnings, right, which there always are, for the company to earn back its price. So a PE of 3, the company's going to earn back that price of the stock in 3 years. A PE of 20 takes 20 years. A PE of 10,000? I know, we were worried about the Y2K problem back in 1998-1999. These people are got to start worrying about the Y5K problem. Oh, no, I'm sorry, 10K. 10K problem. Yeah, what are we going to do eventually? We're going to go from ninth year 9,999 to 10,000. We have to start No, we don't. I mean, you and I don't have to. Growth stocks, as we said, typically mean they are high PEs. Value stocks typically have low PEs, but remember our discussion of growth versus value. A value stock might not necessarily be a good value. It might be, it might not be. And a growth stock might not be a good value or might be a great value. You getting the feeling that exactly. I hope you get that unsettled feeling because that's what it's like to try to predict how well stocks are going to do. Exactly. Some people become so sure of themselves. In fact, there's a saying, they fall in love with a stock. Well, it may work out for you. It may not. Slide number 9. The next ratio we're going to take a look at is price to cash flow. And price to cash flow is very similar to price to earnings, except for one major difference. Earnings are an accounting number. That's how much we report to the IRS for tax purposes. But cash flow is often differs from earnings per share. It's often a different number. Why is that? Well, the one major reason, but there are others, is depreciation. So you accounting students, when you were doing your accounting and you created an entry for depreciation, did the company actually write out a check for that amount to depreciation? No, they didn't. You don't write a check to depreciation. You put it in your ledger and say that we have reduced our earnings by so much because of depreciation. But that cash didn't leave your checkbook. So you understand? You understand? That's an accounting entry that allows us to reduce our earnings so that we don't pay so much to the IRS. Cool. But that cash came into the company. So we take a look at the price to cash flow and take a look at seeing how that differs from price to earnings. And then what you will hear analysts say, are they good quality earnings or are they poor quality earnings? Huh? What are they talking about? Well, here's what happened during the internet mania of the late 90s. Many companies were reporting record earnings. But at the same time, their cash flow was negative. Well, that doesn't make any sense, does it? you tell people, hey, I am earning more than I ever did before, but my checking account is going down. What? Well, a tremendous example of this is the company Lucent Technologies, which is now merged with a French telecommunications company. Lucent Technologies came out of the old AT&T. It used to be called Bell Labs Western Electric. And they make some of the best telephone equipment in the world. And sure enough, as cell phones were becoming very popular in the 90s, as wireless internet and infrastructure was being built out, Lucent Technologies products were in big demand. But many of the companies that bought Lucent Technologies products were startups that didn't have $2 billion to buy the system so that they could sell cell phone usage. And so they could not go to the bank. They could not go to the bond market and borrow this money. They would go directly to Lucent and say, look, we're Windstar. And you don't remember Windstar because they're gone. We would like to buy $2 billion of your equipment. But, you know, we don't really have any cash to do it. So would you sell us the equipment and take back the loan, it's often said. In other words, we'll owe you, Lucent Technology, the money, and over the next 20 years we'll pay you back your $2 billion. Yeah, how did that work out? Not so well. In fact, Lucent Technologies went from $80 down to 80 cents, I think. And I kept saying, buy it. It's not going to go under. Maybe it will. Buy it. Maybe it will. It almost did. And it wasn't because their products were not fabulous. They are. They're, as we said, some of the best telephone equipment in the world. But they had poor quality earnings. They're reporting record earnings, and they're losing money. Exactly. So that's why we have to dig deep more. We have to dig deep past the earnings and take a look at the cash flow. Is your checkbook going up or is it going down? Slide number 10, price to sales ratio. This is the current price divided by the annual sales per share. So we got price to earnings, price to cash flow, price to sales. And historically, a higher price to sales ratio suggested a higher sales growth, and a lower price to sales ratio suggested a lower sales growth. So we're doing the exact same thing we did with price to earnings and the price to cash flow, but now we're relating price to our sales revenue. And it's the same idea that we saw in the previous one. Many analysts in the internet mania were using price to sales instead of price to earnings or price to cash flow. Why? Because the companies weren't generating any earnings, right? They were losing money. They were startups. So, well, let's look at their sales. And you keep selling stuff, but you keep losing money. Are you going to be in business forever? No, you're not. You can't do that, folks. Your businesses can't do that. You can't continue to sell more and more and more and more and be really happy, but lose money every year. Eventually, you're going to wind up in bankruptcy, and that's exactly what happened to many of these internet companies and telecommunications companies. Not all, right? We have still with us Amazon and eBay. And believe it or not, AOL is still around. But and then there's another one called CMGI. I think they've actually survived. They were the darling. You never heard of them, most of you folk, young folks, but certainly. But they were the darling back then. And I think they're still around, believe it or not. So you got it. Price to earnings, price to cash flow, price to sales. And then the last one is price to book ratio. In Chapter 5, I ask you to take a look at the book ratio. And what this does is this compares the market price, the price that people are willing to pay, with what the company is worth on the books. We often say on the books because they used to be books, right? Now it's all computerized. The accountants would say, hey, we have this much assets. And we take our assets, and then we subtract out our liabilities, and that gives us our book value. And if a price-to-book ratio was greater than one, and it almost always is, the shareholders believe that the firm was creating value above and beyond the physical assets of the corporation, which is a fancy way of saying the company is worth more as a company intact than if you just liquidated all the assets, paid off the debts, and walked away. Now we see the price-to-book ratio much higher than we used to see it 50, 60, 100 years ago. And when the price, the market price, goes below the book value, that's actually a very dangerous position for a company to be in, because it attracts what are called corporate raiders, takeover artists, private equity firms, they go by various names, and they can swoop in, buy 50% plus one of the shares, and now they control the company, and then they vote to liquidate the company, pay off all the creditors, sell off all the assets, and then walk away with money in their pocket. Now, it sounds easier than it actually is. It's not something that can be done all the time. But if you're one of the employees, we discussed this, right? If you're one of the employees and you see your company bought up and liquidated, how do you feel? Not too happy, especially if you've been there for many years. And you have a tendency to curse capitalism then. How dare you, you communist. But the economists and the corporate raiders, while they pocket a tremendous sum of money, will tell you, you don't understand. This company has capital locked in it, and we've got to unlock that capital. We need to have that money. It's a fancy word, capital, fancy word for money, resources, utilized in a much better way, and we're facilitating that utilization. Good, great. That makes you feel great. You don't have any food on the table. That is why we have the social safety network, why we have unemployment insurance, and it's become a bit of a political football because certain people say, oh, we're paying people not to work. And obviously there's going to be some people who work the system, but no, it's, we want this. We want companies to be plowed under like a field of old crops to make way for the new. But at the same time, we don't want to plow under the employees too, okay? Okay, so there's our little political discussion for today. Slide number 12. Now, all right, Piano, this is all well and good, but how do we make money with this, right? What are the applications of the price ratio analyses? And what I'm going to tell you, when you go in Chapter 6, you're going to find that they put this at the back of the chapter, which is a bit of a mistake because this is actually easier than the next presentation, where it doesn't mean you shouldn't read the chapter from front to back, but just realize that I'm doing this in reverse order because these are actually pretty straightforward once you've done them the first time. It's actually easier to do it than it is to explain it. That's why I like the face-to-face class, because we do it together, but you'll see them. You'll see them. They're not that hard. To predict the future stock price using price ratios, what do? Well, we multiply a historical price ratio by the expected future value price ratio denominator. Huh? What? Hang on a minute. This is from the sixth edition on page 204. But, you know, the fifth and the fourth edition are basically the same. He's got to find the right page. In late 2009, when the sixth edition was published, the stock price for Intel was $19.40. And in late 2009, the earnings per share, that's what EPS stands for, write that down so you, when you see it again, you won't think it's extended play albums, was 92 cents. Uh-oh, there goes the phone. My apologies. 92 cents. That's got to be my sister-in-law because she calls at this time every day. So what analysts did in late 2009, not all of them, but many of them would do, is they would go back 5 years and take a look at the average P.E. ratio. And it turns out that the average P.E. ratio for Intel in the last 5 years, starting in late 2009, was 20.96, a little over 20. Now, the analysts estimated, or the company itself predicted that the earnings per share growth was 8.5%. They believed that next year, Intel would be earning 8.5% more earnings than they are in late 2009. Okay, so what can we do with that information? Well, what we can do is we can say, look, if the historical P.E. ratio is 20.96, we can multiply that historical P.E. ratio times the projected earnings per share. Well, what would the projected earnings per share be? They would be the current earnings per share, whatever Intel is making right now, times 1 plus the expected growth rate, 100%, right? 1 is 100%, and then we believe it's 8.5% more, so that would be 1 plus 8.5%, 100% plus 8.5%. So the calculation is actually pretty simple. You take the 20.96 times the 0.92 of earnings per share. So you take the historical P.E. ratio of 20.96 times the earnings per share in late 2009, and that's 92 cents. You know, we looked that up. And then we multiply that times 1 plus the expected growth rate of 0.058, 8.5%. And if you work that on your calculator, you get $20.92. So we believe that in 1 year, in late 2010, in this case, the stock is going to be worth $20.92. So even, you know, you read it, multiply historical price ratio by the expected future value price ratio denominator, it doesn't make any sense. But all we're doing is we're saying, look, if this is what the P.E. ratio is going to be, this has been the average over the last 5 years, and this is what we're earning right now, and we expect to earn, you know, 8.5% more, the stock price should go up by that amount. Okay, but does it? Well, no, in a year, right? Slide number 13. And then we just do the exact same thing for price to cash flow. Yeah, exactly. It's just the exact same application. In this case, in late 2009, the price was $19.40, and their cash flow per share was $1.74. Now, wait a minute. How come Intel was earning 92 cents in late 2009, but their cash flow, their checkbook, was being increased by $1.74? They were bringing in $1.74 per share. Well, Intel and other companies that make chips have tremendous depreciation costs. Why? Because it cost them $2 billion to make the first one. Once they make the first chip, then the rest of them are a buck or $2 or less. You know, it depends on what kind of chip they are, but their chips are pretty sophisticated. The processors that they make, and they sell them for $100 and $200, and people say, what do you mean you're selling it for $100 or $200? It only cost you a few bucks to make it. And Intel says, no, it didn't. Yeah, once we made the first one, it only cost us a few bucks, but it cost us $2 billion to get the first one. You see, when you learn about managerial accounting and that, you'll see, oh, yeah, the fixed costs are tremendous, the upfront costs are tremendous. So they're having tremendous depreciation costs that allow them to reduce their earnings so they don't pay as much in taxes. But at the same time, that $1.74 is still coming in the door. Their checkbook is still getting fattened by that amount. And so we then take a look at their five-year average price to cash flow ratio to 10.85. So that means the analysts went back 5 years and took a look at Intel's cash flow, price to cash flow ratio, and found that it was 10.85. So you see the assumption they're making? That next year it's going to still be 10.85. They're looking at the average. They're not looking at the variance, are they? Right. This should be little alarm bells ringing in your head, right? Maybe not. Maybe there are. And then they believe, the analysts, or maybe Intel said, you know, we expect to see a cash flow per share growth of 7.5%. So we do the exact same calculation, which hopefully do it a few times. It won't be as scary as it looks. You take the historical price to cash flow ratio, the 10.85 that we took a look at and computed because it's public information. And then we multiplied it by what we believe their cash flow per share will be next year. Well, how do we do that? We take the current cash flow per share and we multiply it times 100%, 1, plus the 7.5%, 0.075. So here's the calculation. 10.85, the 5-year average price to cash flow, times the $1.74 of cash flow per share that's coming in the door in late 2009, and we say that that cash flow per share is going to increase by 7.5%, so we multiply that times 1 plus 1.075, and we get $20.29. Again, you know, it's going to increase. We expect the stock price to be better next year than it is this year because the cash flow is going to increase. And then lastly, we do the exact same calculation with the price to sales. So again, let's go through it together again. $19.40, but in this case, we have sales of $6.76. Now, wait a minute. That's a lot compared to the earnings per share. Yeah, we got to pay people to do the work, right? Exactly. And you got to buy all the materials and the, exactly. So yeah, sure, the sales is much higher. And then we go back 5 years and find that the price to share ratio was 3.14. And the analysts, or maybe Intel, says, we believe that sales are going to increase 7% next year. So we do the exact same thing. We take the historical price to sales ratio and multiply that times the projected sales per share, which the sales per share next year we expect to be the current sales per share, multiplied times 1 plus the expected growth rate of the sales per share. And we get the 3.14, the 5-year average price to sales. We get the $6.76 of sales per share that we've recorded in late 2009. And we multiply that times 1 plus 0.07, 100% plus 7%, 1.07. And we get $22.71. Well, this is a bit more optimistic, isn't it? Whereas the other two were in the $20.50 range or so, this is expecting us to see a stock price of $22.71. Okay, fine. Now, these calculations, as we found, are actually easier to do than it is to understand it. And so go back and do the calculations again. There's worksheet number 1, which has a commentary and an answer key. There's worksheet number 2, which will... It's not up there yet, but it will be a commentary, and there's an answer key already. And then there are the assignment for Chapter 6, which, hint, is going to look very much the same. And then the exam is going to look all going to be exactly the same. So do it enough times, and you will find that these actually are pretty darn straightforward once you figure out what you're doing, once you understand, oh, put that number here, put that number here, put that number here. Oh, bingo. Slide number 15, reality check. Reality check. Can we reasonably assume that the formulas on the previous slides will give us realistic figures? Well, for many companies, yes, but for a whole lot more, no. There are countless other factors at work. I already made this analogy. It's like trying to predict the weather, only worse. You know it's going to happen. Someday it's going to rain. You don't know when, right? Someday it's going to be sunny. Actually, when you live in San Diego, we're very lucky that way. If you were the weatherman or weatherwoman here, all you have to do is say night and morning, low clouds, sunny days, and you'd be right 89% of the time. The major assumptions of these models is that the price multiples will remain constant. Right. However, we are using the 5-year averages, without taking into account the variances and standard deviations of the averages. Remember them? How far we vary from the average annual? Is it reasonable to expect predictions from these models to be accurate if the variances of the averages are large? No. And so let's take a look at how well we actually did. For the record, on slide number 16, the price of Intel 1 year later in late 2010 was around $20.50. Not bad. Well, one out of four ain't good, folks. The predictions for the third, the fourth, and the fifth editions for the next year prices of Intel were far away from the actual prices. The predictions for the third edition were $19.61, $27.54, and $31.63. And the actual price 1 year later was $33.50, so they were all too low. The fourth edition was $50.84, $43.49, and $40.92, and the actual price 1 year later was $17.50. They were all too high, and the same thing was true for the fifth edition, $25.47, $25.36, $29.63, and boy, they all look similar, and the year later, it was $20. So notice that the third edition's predictions were too low. The fourth and the fifth edition predictions were too high. Gives you lots of confidence in the price models, huh? No, it doesn't. But take heart. The prediction for Disney, you've heard of them, right? From the book, were much closer to the actual prices. Well, wait a minute. Now think about it. A company like Disney is far less volatile than a company like Intel, isn't it? You know, people, no matter what happens, they make fewer times, but they go to those theme parks, and they buy that junk, and they go to their movies, and sometimes Disney has a blockbuster, and then sometimes they have a dud that they spent $200 million on. But it's a much more stable company, you see? So we have to be careful. We have to take a look at these price models and say, you know, for some companies they're going to work okay, and other companies, eh. All right, so go back and do these again. Do worksheet number one, the first three problems. Do worksheet number two, the first three problems. Your assignment, the first three problems. They're always going to be in the exact same order in the presentation, in the worksheets, in the assignment, and on the exam. Great. Now, when we come back, ooh, boy, are you in for a treat. Because we're going to learn a technique that is just, I can't tell you how much it excites me to compute the discounted cash flows of a stream of future income. I just cannot tell you how much that warms my heart. And I hope that once you can do it and can understand what I just said, it will warm your heart too. So see you in our second presentation of Chapter 6.